random holography.
Okay, thank you. It's really great to be here. I've been learning a lot. And so I'm going to be talking about a construction that you could call a random holographic construction. But I want to start with my motivation for thinking about this problem, which is a very concrete question in quantum information theory, before I get to this particular construction of this randomized state. And then finally at the end, there'll be some difference from the usual, perhaps, interpretation of mirror constructions with an ADS geometry. It might be, and I'd really welcome any input from people more knowledgeable about gravity than I, it might correspond to some different kind of bulk geometry. So let me start with this question in quantum information theory. And one thing that's been a theme of this conference has been a question of entanglement and gap in quantum systems. And I want to talk about a relation between two other quantities, entanglement and correlations. So if you just sort of have a hand-waving argument and you ask someone, well, why do we think that in a gapped quantum system there should be some kind of area law for entanglement, the heuristic argument might go something like this. Well, imagine I have a one-dimensional system and I have some region A here, some small region B here, and then the rest of it is region C here. So I break this long line up into three regions, and B will sort of have some length that's of order the correlation length. Then you say, well, A and C, there should be no correlations between A and C because it's larger than the correlation length. So perhaps every degree of freedom in A is entangled with something in B, so the entanglement entropy of A should be at most the entanglement entropy of B, and the entanglement entropy of B is bounded by the length of B times, say, log 2 if it's qubits on each site, and so that'll be bounded by the correlation length. Now, this is the heuristic argument, and of course, you have to ask whether this heuristic argument is at all reasonable. And we do know that if it's a gap system, really there is exponentially decaying correlation between A and C, but the rest of this argument is kind of nonsense. And the reason the rest of this argument is kind of nonsense is if you write down just a completely random quantum state, not coming from any Hamiltonian, you just write down a random state on these three systems, with B being L qubits, what you'll find is that the correlations, as measured by some kind of OA operator, OA on A and OC on C, that you'll have very small correlations. And yet you'll find that the entanglement on A is actually enormous. So there's some kind of problem with this argument. And what you can have is you can have a very small amount of entanglement, but what you can have is that the density matrix rho AC does not factor into a product of rho A times rho C. So there's some large there's this failure for the density matrix to factor. So these are really two different questions, and you might then try to go beyond this and ask, well, this is just sort of, I've kind of ignored all the structure here. I've just written down three subsystems, and you might want to try and get like a many-body version of this state. And such states were constructed. One way to do this is to write down essentially a random matrix product state. So you have, I'm sure, this kind of construction of matrix product states has been drawn many times. So what you have is, at every site, you have a tensor. So you have some tensor A on each site. And I'll even make it a translation invariant state. So it's the same tensor at every state. And on every bond, you have some bond variables, so alpha, beta, gamma, and so on. And you have some degrees of freedom, S1, S2 at each site. And what you do is you sum over all these internal bond variables. I think Giffray reviewed all this kind of, or I didn't review MPS. OK. You sum over all these internal bond variables and with a weight that depends upon this tensor, and this gives you a state on these indices. So the amplitude to be in some state S1, S2, S3, and so on is A of S1 times A of S2, and so on, where what I mean by A of S1 is A is a three-index tensor. When you say A of S1, you're left with a matrix, and you just multiply these matrices. So this is a matrix product state. These are things that play an enormous role in density matrix or normalization group and other algorithms. But if you simply say, well, I'm going to write down random matrices for these A, we'll make them all the same, but we'll make them random. What you'll come up with is a many-body state that has this effect of having exponentially decaying correlations, but enormous amounts of entanglement. So we can take this dimension of the physical degrees of freedom to be small, say 2 or 3 or something like that. We take these A's to be random matrices with some enormous dimension, 1,000, 1,000,000, whatever, as big as you want. And what you find is that the entropy, the entanglement entropy across any cut, will go roughly as the log of the dimension of A. It won't be exactly maximal, but it'll be very close to maximal. So it'll be very highly entangled, and yet the correlation length will be quite short. And the reason the correlation length will be quite short is that, for those who know a bit about tensor networks, the way you go evaluate the expectation value of any operators is you take this state, and then you insert its complex conjugate state, and then somewhere over here you insert an operator on A, and then somewhere over here you insert an operator on C, and you do all this summation. And what you're left with is looking at a transfer matrix for transferring 1 over, which is exactly this little gadget here with two of these things inserted. And if you study the spectrum of this transfer matrix, it has a gap in it. So what you find, and it has a gap in a uniform way, so that even as I make the dimension of these matrices big, the gap stays of order 1. And so this leads to an exponential correlation decay. However, then after that, there was a so it seems then that you could have as much entanglement as you want and yet exponentially decaying correlations. Yes, Gefrey?
Are you going to go through the argument that so if you trace out a few spins in the middle, mm-hmm. you still get that rho A and rho C. Rho A C is not factorized.
Yeah, you get that. In this case, you mean on this matrix product state, you get that rho A C is not factorized. Well, you know that it can't factorize because the fixed point of this transfer matrix will be close to the maximally mixed state. It won't be exactly the maximally mixed state, but it'll be something close to it. And so you know the entanglement has to be close to maximal. So there's no way it could factorize if you went from here and here, because if it did factorize, the entanglement entropy would be at most whatever you trace
up. After you trace a block on the order of the correlation length.
Yeah, but you know it can't factorize. So if you trace out, you know, a block of order correlation length, which is like 5 sites or something not very big, if it did factorize, then the entanglement entropy of A could only be at most 5 log 2 or something like that. But you just know it's not. It's actually close to maximal. Yeah.
Finite pieces in the lattice, they factorize.
For
finite regions in a large lattice.
Yeah, if you take them far enough apart, then eventually it does factorize, yes.
The point is that you have to go way.
You have to go much further than you might think, yeah. You have to go much further than the correlation length to get. Small little regions like this and this will factorize well. It's this all the way over and this all the way. Exactly. No, you're completely right, yeah. That's completely right. Yes, small regions, it's more like, as you say, like a thermal state, that the local regions will factorize, but it's this large block that doesn't. So then, yeah?
So your statement that OA, OC has a small expectation value, there's a lot of OAs and OCs.
Yes.
And are there a lot of them that have a small?
So this is essentially the problem, yeah, that like each one is small, but the factorization requires that you actually have exponentially many, so you have to balance it. Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. So a short time after this, though, there appeared other ways of proving an area law in one dimension for a gap system. But then after that, there appeared a paper by Fernando Brandão and Michel Horodecki that proved a theorem that said that if you do have exponentially decaying correlations in one-dimensional system, then you have an entanglement entropy that's leaving out a lot of factors, roughly bounded by the exponential in 1 over the correlation length. And of course, it seems like there's a contradiction here, because I just said, well, no, the entanglement entropy can be as big as you want if there's a bounded correlation. And yet Fernando and Michel proved that, no, actually, there's an upper bound. So it would seem that one of us would need to be wrong. But there's a slight difference in the kind of correlations we considered. I wrote down correlations where it was OA over here and OC over there. But they also considered correlations of the form where A was supported here and C is supported both here and here, with some spacing between them. So they considered also some other C could be disconnected in this case. And in that case, they were able to prove that there would be this correlation, this entanglement bound. But it's an incredibly weak bound, It's exponential in 1 over the correlation, exponential in the correlation length. They wrote it as, it's exponential in the correlation length is what I mean to write. I was thinking of exponential in 1 of the gap. I was remembering different results. Exponential in the correlation length. So you would think the entanglement entropy would just be the correlation length, but no, it can be exponentially larger. So you can have this absolutely still now bounded in some way, but actually absolutely enormous. And so, the question that motivated the construction I'm going to talk about is whether their bound is tight or not. Is it simply that they were not able to prove a better bound, or is it in fact that you really can write down states, you know, maybe instead of this random MPS state, some other kind of state that will have such a large entanglement entropy as this, and yet still exponentially decaying correlations even of that sort. And so that's the motivation. And now I want to get to my next thing, which is the actual class of states that I'm going to talk about. So these are not going to be random MPS states, but they're going to be perhaps.
But the seeming contradiction of what you proved,
yeah,
is that that inequality does not depend on bond dimension.
The
one in the stone board does not.
This. Yeah. Well, this. So the seeming contradiction, yeah, is that I can make S as big as I want.
By increasing bond dimension.
Yeah. But they're saying that in fact, at some point, the states that I'm writing down will not have exponential decay of correlations of this form. So they also consider it they have a stronger hypothesis. So the seeming contradiction is that when people say exponential decay of correlations, you have to really unpack that to say exactly, you know, what is the hypothesis there? And it was a little bit different which correlations had to decay. So the class of states that I'm going to talk about is sort of natural. You know, I've talked about random MPS. So instead, what I'm going to talk about is random Mara states. So I'm sure we've seen the Mara picture many times here. So what you have is you have this branching construction with some isometries here. So you start with a state in a zero-dimensional Hilbert space, and then you apply some map that's an isometry that maps it into two states. Then each of those gets mapped into two more. Then what happens is there's some disentangler that takes these two and then maps them out. So this is a quantum circuit where time goes this way, so states get mapped as we go downwards. Then these ones come along. Then there's another layer of branching. Then there's more layers of disentanglers. So everywhere we've got a cross, there's some kind of isometry sitting there, and so on. So you have this construction of a Mara state where as you go down, the number of leads of this grows exponentially with the number of levels of the Mara. So the construction I want to put in is I want to talk about putting in random isometries for this. And this is a kind of construction that I think you would never see in string theory because it's far too tangible a construction to put in the random isometries here. So what we're going to do is we're going to just have some dimensions that I'm going to write down. So we're going to put dimensions d1 here, I think I was calling d1 prime, d2, d2 prime, and so on. So I'm just going to have various bond dimensions. And they're not going to be the specific bond dimensions that you usually use in a Mara. And this is going to be why I think there's perhaps a different bulk geometry here. So usually in a Mara, for computational reasons, you would take the bond dimension to be something small at most levels and typically fixed. But here I'm going to take a very different choice of the bond dimensions. And then what I'm going to do is I'm just going to say, well, this isometry is just going to be a random isometry from a space of dimension d1 to a space of dimension d1 prime times d1 prime. This one here, so this is going from d1 prime and d1 prime to d2, d2, this is going to be a random isometry from a space of dimension d1 prime squared to d2 squared, and so on. So it's just they're each going to be random. They're going to be chosen independently. So this one's going to be independent to this one, and they're all just going to be har random. So measure invariant under left and right unitary rotations. I'm going to tell you what I picked for the d's later. So yeah. It's actually going to be increasing pretty rapidly. I want to now sort of split into two different things that I'm talking about. One is completely independent of the choice I take for the d's is going to be how do you compute entanglement entropies in this state? And the interesting property is that rather than being a single curve, in a sense it's going to be a sum over curves. And then the second is going to be what choice of d's do I put in order to make it interesting from this point of view of the Brandau and Horodecki result. Okay, so let's say we have this Mara here. And you're given a task of, okay, here's some interval at the bottom, perhaps this interval. And someone says, okay, compute for me the entanglement entropy of this interval with the rest of the system. Well, in this case, I can certainly make one simplification. I can say, well, you know, these two sites here, they come out of an isometry. So it's actually really just and the same for these two. So I can just turn it into this entanglement entropy of an interval one level higher. So in this case, I can at least simplify it and then just ask in a slightly simpler state. But suppose I wasn't asked that question initially. Suppose instead I was asked the question of, and then we'll run into a trouble at the next level, but let me suppose I was asked a different question at the first level. I was asked the entanglement entropy of this interval. So I can simplify these two by pushing them up, these two by pushing them up, but here I have a problem. I have a problem right here that makes it hard to compute the entanglement entropy. So let's call this interval I. So I'm asked to compute S of I. Well, let me just give a couple sort of trivial bounds. One thing is that in this case, I already told you how to compute the interval. So let me call these sites for notational use later B1, B2, and let me call this whole interval I. Let me call this portion of it C. So this is going to be C. These are B1 and B2. This site is B1 and this site is B2. So I want to compute the entropy of what we'll call B2C. So that's clearly less than the entropy of B2 plus the entropy of C. This is an inequality we have. And the entropy of B2 is at most the log of whatever this dimension is here, D2 prime, plus the entropy of C. And this entropy of C, I already told you I know how to move that up one level. So this gives me one sort of kind of naive bound. It says, well, I can just throw out that site and then move it up one level. Or if I wanted to, I could, instead of removing that site, I could add a site. So I also know that S of B2C C is smaller than log of D2 prime plus S of B1 B2C. So adding the two sites. And again, when I add in these two sites, I get something that I can move up a level. So I have two inequalities that I have here. Either remove a site on the left end or add a site on the left end to make it take this nice length. And again, similarly on the right end, if the right end didn't perfectly happen to line up, if it was off by one, I could remove or add a site and then push it up one level. So this just gives me an upper bound, but it gives me a whole bunch of upper bounds. So whatever interval you give me, I can have a sequence of adding or removing sites at left and right end so that I can push it higher until eventually I push it to nothing. So maybe if I started, maybe I remove this site, so I get this interval, then I get this one, and I say, okay, well, I'm going to take the hit there and remove that site, and remove that site, then push this one up to here, and then finally remove that site. So I have this sequence, I have various sequences, and I call them reduction sequences. So let me call Q is reduction sequence. And it's just a sequence of choices of how to either slightly increase or decrease the length of the interval to move it one level higher. And every time you do that, you pay a price in entropy, which is log of the dimension of whatever you added or removed. So we just have some very simple bound that S of any interval is smaller than the minimum over all reduction sequences, S of Q, where S of Q is the sum of all these prices that I pay. You know, log D here, log D there, whatever. It's all these dimensions that I'm adding and subtracting. And if you want, what you can think of is when I remove this guy, and then maybe remove this guy, remove this guy, remove this guy, what I'm doing is I'm generating curves in the bulk space here. So I'm taking a minimum over curves in the bulk space and something of what they cut.
Yeah.
Well, it might stop because I get down to one site, and then I just say, well, the entropy of the one site is at most just the log of the dimension. So yeah, so I sum over sequences that terminate. I mean, eventually I have to get to the top, so eventually it terminates. So all the sequences terminate somewhere, but of course the minimal ones will typically terminate much lower. Yeah.
So to check the ground down,
Yeah, I'm about to get to that right now. That's my next. I know. I just, you're like, well, yeah, of course you want a lower bound. I just gave an upper bound. But I'm gonna give the lower bound in a second. Yeah. Pop off both ends in, what do you
mean? You called this a curve.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I would have thought that it might be a case where it's simplest to, your interval is almost the whole system, and you pop off to one side, and you pick off this side, and you have nothing left, you just raise it up.
Oh, I mean, you're asking, would I ever want to remove something in the middle?
No. I'm really asking, is your reduction sequence always, I mean, it's approximately a continuous curve?
Well, yeah, I mean, so certainly I have the case that I might have something at this level, but not at the next. So what I have is, but I have some interval here, and then the interval includes this site. So the length of the interval is always increasing or decreasing by one. But it can, I mean, one thing that is worth mentioning, and it's completely within this formalism that I've written here, is if you gave me an interval that was all of the system except for a little bit, so it's the minimum over all sequences. So one sequence actually is, rather than shrinking it that way, is to lengthen it. And now I have it the whole system, and now I don't pay any more price all the way up. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I guess in that sense,
which is a sequence of segments. It's not necessarily a connected curve.
Yeah, it's a sequence of segments, but the endpoints of the segments will move by at most one in either direction as I go up. So sort of piecewise, kind of like a curve. I don't know, heuristically a bit like a curve.
You could trace out a curve using the endpoints.
Exactly.
But the curve doesn't always cross the lines of the graph.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, but as you asked there, I need a lower bound is what I really want. So this is an upper bound, but what I'm going to give is a lower bound that the expectation value, because this is a random thing, the expectation value of the entropy is actually going to be greater than or equal to the minimum of all these sequences minus a correction term. And the correction term is some O of 1 times what I'll call H of Q, where H of Q is the height of the sequence. It's how far up I need to go before the thing disappears. So you lose, there's like an O of 1 correction term at every level, which is not that big. And then based on how I choose the dimensions, you know, roughly you can see that this H of Q is typically only going to be the log of the length scale, while actually my entropies will be much larger. So the upshot will be that this S of Q up to some small corrections literally is the entropy. Because this will be the expectation value of the entropy. So how do I get this? I don't actually first, you know, this is the result I really want, is expectation value of the von Neumann entropy. But let me do it first for the Rainey entropy, the S2 Rainey entropy. And then I have the nice inequality that the von Neumann entropy is bigger than the Rainey entropy. So I'm going to look at S2. So now it's time to draw more tensor network pictures. So I want to leave this up here. And let's just consider exactly this case where I have B1, B2, C, and then everything else I'll call A. So I've divided the system into three parts, A, B, and C. And actually, just again for some notes, then we see this C, we can push up one level. So we've got C here. Let me call these two sites at the higher level B. So what I have is at the higher level, this level here, I have some wave function that's a function of A, B, and C. And so I can write that as, just try and keep my notation straight. So I can write that as some wave function in A, B, and C. So what I'm just noting here is that a wave function is just a function of the state on A, state on B, state on C. So let me just write it as a three-index tensor. And then what I do is I hit it with this isometry here. So I get something on B1, B2, and C. So this is the state. Then what I want to do is I want to trace out the state on A and B1 and look at the entropy on B2 and C. So I'm going to construct a tensor network that computes the exponential of minus the S2 entropy, which is to say trace of rho B2C squared. So let's draw some more pictures. Let's draw this A line going upwards, curve this B1 line around. Then I need to put in, so here I put in psi. So here I'm going to put in the complex conjugate of psi. So all this is A. This splits. And this. So that's rho B2C that I've written here. And now I need to copy it to get the square of it. So what's that? I'm missing, there we go. Tough to draw the tensor networks right on the fly on the board. Okay, so I want to basically compute this where I join the lines at the top and the bottom. So this is rho B2C, and I've just repeated it. So now I've got the square.
What was psi?
Psi is just the wave function that I had at this level. So I want to compute the entanglement entropy at this level given the isometry and given the wave function at this level. And now I'm going to just average over this isometry W. So I'm really computing trace of rho squared, averaging over W. So I'm going to reduce it to a problem at one higher level. So psi is the wave function at the next higher level. So now I need a way to average over these isometries W. And what I need is a nice little identity that I'm going to write pictorially. So let's say I have a W, W bar, W, W bar. And here I'm writing it as if it goes one index in and one out. That is, I'm grouping the two out indices into a single one, because W is random under any rotation on these output space. It doesn't know about how I've divided it in this way. And what I mean by this is, so this is just some tensor as a function of these two, and I want to look at the expectation value of this thing averaging over W. And all you can get is essentially something that I'll write pictorially. It's going to involve various tensors, but one of them is something like this. It's this index and this index have to be the same, this and this have to be the same, and so on. All I can do is write down something that's invariant under unitary rotations on the left and the right. So it has to be some delta function of the indices. So it's going to be this with some coefficient, this with the same coefficient, and then some other coefficient, which is much smaller, for things like that and like that. So now I know what the average of W is. You can work out what the coefficients are in terms of the dimensions. And you just take this expression and plug it into this network. That's important. Yeah, because what I've done is I've ignored the fact here, you know, I've split this space into two. But really what this is indicating, so something like this on the end where it's two, it's indicating that, yeah, there's a delta function between this pair of indices and this pair of indices. So the ones on the end where it's two are really like two delta functions. It's sort of, in this case, I'm ignoring the fact that the space has a further decomposition. And now over here, I'm going to remember that the space has a further decomposition. So if you want, you could write each of those delta functions as a product of two delta functions. So what I get, but this is, Shelley?
Isometry, not
unitary. It's an isometry, yeah.
So they generally have different dimensions.
Yes.
I thought you can't get a better function in this higher dimensional space from...
Well, on average, all you can get is a delta function. The WW dagger is not a delta function in the higher dimensional space. It's just a projector. But the average over all choices of W smooths the projector out, so you get a delta function. You get a delta function less than one. So that's all in these C's and C primes, which I'm not going to work out on the blackboard. And so some of them are bigger or less than one. So now what I need to do is take that. The C prime is negligible. So really the important ones are the first two, the C's. I can take this W and contract it with this W, and this with this, or vice versa, this and this with this. So let's just, for simplicity, do this one with this one first. So what that says is really, I have a delta function between this pair of indices and this pair, and then this one and this one. So what I actually have is this short circuits to here, this short circuits to here, and this short circuits to there, like that. And now I need to do the same thing up above here. So then this goes to here, this goes to here, and then this one goes to here. So I have a bunch of closed loops with bond dimensions, which are these dimensions d2 prime of here and here. And if you sum over the weight of the loops, 3 minutes left. Okay. Oh yeah, sorry, I had a bunch of questions. I told you I'd watch the clock, but then I didn't. Okay. So when you sum over the weight of these loops, what you do, ignore the weight of the loops for a second. They're just sort of confusing you. What you see that I've really written down here is exactly tracing out all of B and all of C. So what I've done is I've got one term, which really just is the weight when I threw out this site completely, or the weight when I put it in completely. So my two different weights are exactly the two different terms in the reduction sequence. So on average, in fact, the exponential of minus the S2 is the sum of the two minus S2s in the reduction sequence. Using some convexity properties and concavity of the exponential and the logarithm to relate average of exponential to exponential of average, using some O of 1 corrections because I'm really adding the two things together, what you get in the end is exactly what I claimed is the lower bound. So this is how you can go work things out. And what you find really then is that the exponential of minus S2 is a sum over these curves rather than a single curve. But it gets dominated by the largest one. And so that allows you to work out the entropy in any of these things. So now let me just say what choice for the bulk dimensions I want to write to get this bound. What I want to, I'm going to actually have the the bond dimensions grow quite laterally. Whenever I have an isometry with two dimensions d prime coming in, I'm going to make the dimensions d coming out almost the same as d prime. I'm going to have log d is log d prime minus epsilon times L, where L is the length scale at this level. So it's 1 here, 2 here, 4 here, 8 here, and so on. And epsilon is some tiny number. So you're going to lose just a little bit of entropy each time you go up. So there's a very small amount of mutual information between here and here. Whenever I have a split like that, and I have two dimensions d coming in and one dimension d prime coming out, I'm going to take d prime as 2 log d prime. Is 2. Of course, these aren't integers, so you need to slightly round them a little bit to get something with an integer dimension. Is 2 log d minus epsilon l. So again, there's going to be just a little bit of mutual information between here and here, but you're going to keep almost all the entropy when you go up from one level to the next. It's almost remaining at all. And if you iterate this recursion relation, and this recursion relation comes up in my proof of the 1D area law and in the Brandau-Horodecki bound, similar recursion relations. What you find is if you iterate this recursion relation, you ask, how does the available entropy go? What you find is you have an entropy at the bottom level that's like log of your Hilbert space dimension. Then at the next level, it's like twice that minus epsilon L. The next level, it's 4 times that minus 2 epsilon L. And as you go up, you see that this epsilon L term keeps growing and growing logarithmically. And you can get a number of levels in here, which is 1 over epsilon. So you can get a length scale in your system that's 1 over epsilon. Exponential in 1 over your epsilon. And you actually find that the entanglement entropy is going to be exponential in this 1 over epsilon. And then the last thing, which is to verify, in fact, that you have this rapid correlation decay. And this, I wrote in the paper, you know, that is sort of a conjecture, but I think it's really just a matter of, like, filling in a lot of details. There's a large number of details to proving the entanglement, the correlation decay, but I think I'd be very confident in that result. And I guess I'm pretty much out of time. So I won't go into all the details in this specific application, but perhaps I'd be interested if anyone can tell me if this is some kind of interesting geometric interpretation. So thanks.
We have time for several questions.
Sorry, could you repeat the last, you know, the final result? So you had a scaling of entropy?
Right, so the final results are...
What is L, the small L?
Okay, so, right, and I kind of blurred a few things together. So at each of these levels, there's some sort of associated length scale, right, which is one at the, well, it's... one at this level, and then it goes up to two, and so on. If I make a change here, it affects sort of L sites at the bottom.
So 1, 2, and then 3 or 4?
4.
Okay.
1, 2, 4, 8. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So it's the exponential in how high you go up.
Okay.
It's the number of sites in, I guess you call it the causal cone of a site up here. So one of the reasons for picking this is.
So the L is that.
At each level. So this is really a recursion relation from one level to the next as to how this d and d prime goes. And the reason for picking that is that then if you take two intervals of length, of some length L, which is now some other L, I'm slightly abusing the notation, you'll find a mutual information between these two intervals that's roughly this epsilon times L. So what you have is mutual information between neighboring pairs of intervals at all length scales and any neighboring pair of intervals. That you pick, you always find mutual information between this and this and a little bit at all length scales.
Okay, so L was the effective length?
Effective length.
And then you said the correlations?
So the correlation, so I have this epsilon in here. And so the point is if you try to iterate this recursion relation, what you find is that you have like entropy log 2 at the bottom for a single interval of length 1. So then two of them next to each other, roughly, I mean, there's small corrections to this, would be 2 log 2, but it's not quite. It's 2 minus epsilon times 2. It's a little bit smaller. And as you go up, what you should get is 4 log 2 for an interval of length 2, but it's actually corrected to not minus 4 epsilon, but minus 4 epsilon times 2. And this 2 is really the log. It's because I've iterated twice. When I go again, I get 8 log 2 minus 8 epsilon times 3. And eventually this term takes over after a number of levels that's 1 over epsilon. So it's sort of the epsilon controls how far I can iterate this recursion relation before the entropy goes negative.
So before this happens, what's the scaling of entropy as a system?
So the entropy is growing following that recursion relation, but it's close to linear in interval length. It's sort of just less than linear in interval length, because each interval only has a small amount of mutual information with a nearby interval. And that's really, that mutual information tells you how it fails to grow from linear, right? Because if I know the entropy of an interval of length L and an interval of length L, the entropy of an interval of length 2L is twice that minus the mutual information. It says there's a little bit of mutual information at all scales. So it's growing linearly, but what happens is there's this little bit of mutual information that causes it to flatten out slowly, and then eventually you hit some length scale where now the entropy would eventually go negative and it fails to grow as fast. But up to a large scale that's of order 1 over epsilon, order exponential in 1 over epsilon, you can keep iterating this.
And all correlation lengths are small?
So that's the thing that, as I said, that you know I'm very confident in, but you know there's a lot of steps to check, and you have to worry about rare fluctuations. What if we pick a bad choice of these isometries? But I'd be pretty confident that indeed this thing has a bounding correlation length. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm fairly confident of that. This already answers this interesting question of whether you can build up this local mutual information at all scales in this way.
So just to clarify that I understood correctly, so this is not like an MBL phase, right? The state looks like it's disordered, but it doesn't. It has only ultra-local correlations, but the entropy is growing with system size.
Yeah. I mean, this is not, I think, a phase that would be something you would expect to see in an MBL phase or something like that, because it's really a very carefully engineered relation between entanglement and correlation.
But your original MPS state, everything, the random matrices are completely random, right?
Yes. In the MPS one, you just pick random matrix. So no, I mean it's like if you pick a random state, is that what you would get from a random Hamiltonian? And
right.
I don't know this necessarily the case.
So you really don't have any knowledge about the underlying Hamiltonian?
No, I don't think there's necessarily a good Hamiltonian for this. I mean, just on a related note, it seems then from this construction, if instead of making these bond dimensions grow in this funny way, if I had taken random tensors but kept all the bond dimensions fixed, mm-hmm. it seems like I would probably get, you know, this should be checked, but I would probably get something that had entanglement growing logarithmically with length scale and power law correlations just like a CFT, but it would just be some random state that had no relation to any Hamiltonian. So.
Okay, so you could make it go in either direction.
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay. There's one final question over there, and we'll break for coffee.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to understand. So does that mean the entropy is close to being volume law? So that means it's close to be something like a black hole geometry, I'm close to a big black hole.
It is like close to volume law in that, you know, the entropy in this thing really is, you know, the system size is exponential in 1 over this epsilon before I find that this recursion relation can't be iterated, and the entropy is exponential in 1 over epsilon. So it's really...
So if I have a boundary which is a circle, then...
You can do this periodic. I mean, that's actually how I wrote it, but I just...
Then the entropy will go up almost linearly and go down and as a function
yes.
of the size of that.
Yes, yes.
So there is But I can still see like this is not a thermal state.
Can you see that it's not a...
It's not a state which is just some state that satisfies eigenstate thermalization.
I would be surprised, but I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it could in some way be a thermal state. I don't know.
It could be a thermal state.
I mean, locally, and similar to what was asked over there, locally, it just seems like it has very little correlations at all, lots of entropy.
So Gifri has another question if it's short. Oh, you both have
a collective question.
A collective question. Should be
you, have one
we're,
speaker.
We're right on time, so.
Sure.
We wanted to know, if you take a random state in the Hochhilfer space, what's the key qualitative difference between the states that you are getting there in terms of entropy and correlations?
So the entropy properties of a random state in the whole Hilbert space will be very similar, but it will actually have correlations. It will not have the correlation decay that you want in the way that you want, because it doesn't know anything about this locality.
So what's again the correlations here? What type of correlations do you expect?
Here I expect exponentially decaying correlations. Whereas for a random one, you really do have, you know, if you take an inner, you know, you do have some correlations. You do have long range correlations.
May I just follow up? If you take a random state within a certain energy band of a short range Hamiltonian, though, then you expect a volume law and an exponential decay of the correlations.
So there probably then are some subtle many-body correlations that you don't, you know, incorporate.
Yeah, of the two-body correlations, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the two-body will decay, but there are probably some many-body with many-body that are not decaying, simply because we know you really can't strictly have a volume law now after this Brandau-Horodecki result.
So the correlation of question.
Actually, I think there is
a recent paper.
taking in an ergodic state that has supposedly exponentially decaying correlations. There is a paper by, I think, Jens Bardersson and Fabian Heidrich Meissner, who is here, where they take two-point correlation functions and basically diagonalize the matrix of two-point correlation functions, the two-point density matrix, and they see that it has eigenvalues with long-range delocalized eigenvalues. So in principle, there are some long-range correlations there, even for two-point functions. It's just you need to take the right superpositions.
Okay. So I think with that, thank you, Matt. Thank you, Jim. And we now have a break until 10:15.